Support for this program is brought to you by Seagate. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information can be found at Seagate.com. It's Friday at 10 o'clock. Time for Geek Speak. Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gaps between geeks and the rest of humanity. My name is Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed during Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. This morning on Geek Speak, we're talking about Mac, specifically the newly released G5, and the operating system as well, the new 10.3. During the second half of the show, I'll be welcoming you to join our conversation. The numbers are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. I'll be giving out those numbers again in about a half an hour when I invite your participation. This is Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me, our geeks, Miles Elam, Sean Cleveland, John Tracy, and Dee Dee Hubbard. Geeks, welcome to Geek Speak.
Good morning. Hey.
Good morning, Lyle.
We're going to start our discussion about Apple in just a moment, but first, the geek news.
Well, might be some bad news or sobering news, but it looks like the semiconductor industry is not picking up quite as fast as people were hoping. All eyes are turning to manufacturers and fabs, where a lot of these chips are manufactured all over the world, and it looks like right now conditions for the first quarter of 2003 looked pretty much like the first quarter of 2002. When the second half demand failed to materialize, that's when things kind of, you know, took a south turn even further, and that's why we're at today. And people are afraid the same thing's going to happen this year. It looks like fab capacity is increasing as far as upgrades, but they think there's going to, analysts say there's going to be a lot of shortages in products.
Shortages in products meaning there's just not going to be enough of the product for the consumer?
because manufacturers are so scared that there won't be anybody to buy these products
that they're
actually lowering the number that they'll be ordering, and that could affect the economy, especially the tech economy, even more. So it seems to be what happened in 2002 seems to be happening again today.
All right, well, that's kind of sobering news. Miles, what's up with Microsoft and Java?
Federal appeals court has stated that Microsoft does not have to ship Sun's Java virtual machine with their Windows operating system. This was set back. This is to put into context. Years ago, there was an injunction saying that Microsoft couldn't ship their own version, or rather, they could only ship their own version. They couldn't do the Windows update and put in and keep pushing their own version of the Java Virtual Machine. But Sun was alleging that because of competition with .NET and just the Windows.
You know, .NET is Microsoft's what? Runtime environment?
It's a lot of things. The umbrella term for the common language interface, the development tools.
To some degree, it's a competitor with Java.
To some extent. Now, that's how it's seen in many ways.
Now, Sun gives the Java runtime environment for free. Why isn't Microsoft why does Sun care that it's not in, not being distributed by Microsoft?
Well, one of the things behind Java is the fact that it is platform independent. So what you have is a dependency on Sun, to some extent. Not so much, but basically you break the stranglehold with Microsoft, more to the point. So when you have, right now with Windows platforms, when you have a Windows program, you can only use it for Windows. And many people, I'm sure, can attest to this with regards to Macs, that there'd be a program available for Windows, but it's not available for the Mac, or for example, the version of Office would fall behind in features from the Windows version or the browser.
Right.
And Java was going to level the playing field.
And so we'll see how this case turns out.
Well, so far the ruling has been that Microsoft does not have to ship it with them. Their answer as well, statement, has been that Sun could always talk to Dell and whatnot to get manufacturers to put it on themselves. But
Is it going to hurt Java?
I think Java's already hurt. But I also see it going on the server side more than the client side. Anyway, but
years ago, Miles, when we first met, one of the first long discussions I had with you was about Java, and you were touting how wonderful it was, and did a great lesson for me on how Java works. And are you still a strong believer in Java?
Yes, the actual language? I still think it's a great technology, but it's been killed on the client side for all intents and purposes, mostly because of the legal wrangling between Microsoft and Sun. It could have been good. It was slow to begin with. It's gotten faster, but because no one has the faster version by default on their desktop, no one knows, no one cares. Now it's relegated to the server side, where it's doing well.
There. So is this, because it's not in the client side effectively anymore, does this mean that we're going to see even a wider separation between the Mac applications and the Windows applications?
That, I think, is a different issue,
because
Apple still has a lot of pull that's outside of Java applications in general.
I got some news about Google.
And you have a bad mic. Can you try it again? Try your same mic again, actually.
And I got some news about Google. They have a new beta version of their toolbar, which so many people love, because it allows you quick access to Google from any website.
Now, Google's a search engine.
Any webpage you might be viewing.
Google's a search engine. What's the toolbar?
The toolbar sits on Internet Explorer, just like your links or your bookmarks or maybe your personal toolbar where you can dump links onto. And you can type in some text that you'd like to search for using Google's search engine and click I Feel Lucky, Categories, Images, whatever, and it'll perform a Google search for you.
And so you don't have to go to Google front page first to do the search. You go right in your browser or any page you're in. When you hit enter, it then opens Google searching.
Right.
Okay, that's cool.
And so with this new version of Google Toolbar, they're adding a couple new features. Pop-up blocker, which it will be really helpful in blocking some pop-up ads, which are frankly very annoying. Autofill, so for those of you who might be using something like Gator, you can get rid of that. It will fill in little entries like your name on certain websites that you've been to or your address for you. And it also has a new feature to help add hyperlinks to your personal weblogs or personal journals. So you can, without having to copy the URL and then paste it into your weblog and then go back and forth. And so those are some of the new features.
Cool.
So how does this make it different from... So this makes Internet Explorer on par with most other browsers that are out there that have had these features for a couple of years now.
Well, not all those features, but it's true that pop-up blocking is something that Mozilla's had for a while. Yeah. Safari has. I don't think Internet Explorer
does. So being able to search Google from the...
Right from the bar?
Yeah.
Safari does it by default.
Yeah. Mozilla does it. Opera does it.
So there's a lot of things out there that already have it. Now,
yeah.
I got to say that bringing up Google, Google has a lot of innovative fields. They've got a whole team of people that are always kind of creating new things. Something I saw yesterday that they haven't really released is a voice search system. And basically, you get a website address, and then you can call a phone number, and you can read in a text. You can say something, and it will then upload or will refresh your page with that search criteria. I have no idea what the purpose of this is for, but it sounds fascinating. I think this sounds a little more useful to most people, but it's true that it's kind of a duplication of stuff that's already in most browsers, except for Internet Explorer. So now it looks like maybe Microsoft won't have to innovate as much as they normally. Oh, wait.
Careful.
Hi, John. You over there?
I am.
Hi, John. How you doing?
Good.
Good.
Pioneer announced that they're adding TiVo services to their DVD recorders. For those of you who live in a closet and don't know what TiVo is a great way to watch TV. It's a PVR, personal video recorder, that allows you to... It basically records television to a hard drive, which allows you to choose what shows you do and do not want to watch. It allows you to skip over the commercials. A lot of things. Now, Pioneer is adding it to their DVD recorders, which means you can tell your TiVo what shows you want to watch, and then if you really like the show, you can burn it onto DVD. They use DVD-R and DVD.
Wait, is the Pioneer DVD player, DVD recorder, is that actually have a TiVo system in it? Or they just hook together well?
It's an all-in-one system.
Okay, so Pioneer basically has a new TiVo. And the service, I'm supposing, is supported by a TiVo.
Does anybody want to take bets on when an injunction will be placed against this device and it will be pulled off the market?
Gee, why? You don't think this is made to violate copyright law?
I think this is exactly what a VCR is.
But a VCR is not digital. And the Digital Copyright Act says that you can't copy digital copyrighted content.
Which is funny, because we always record stuff to our VCR anyway.
But your VCR is not digital.
You're a criminal, don't copyright that much more.
TiVo's always been really careful in that area, though. So maybe since it's TiVo...
They'll probably decrease the quality, or trains it into an analog signal.
But this is not TiVo. This is Pioneer adding TiVo functionality to their DVD recorder.
Okay, but Pioneer does have a license with TiVo, and is actually using TiVo's whole package, right? Is that what this... article says, John?
Yeah, it's an all-in-one package.
It's a relationship.
No, it is
Pioneer
an all-in-one package now. Yeah.
So now I'm actually curious. If you did pass it through a digital to analog, then an analog to digital converter, just because you're saving it.
Does that get you around the laws?
Well, I mean, because you'd be saving an analog signal. You're just converting it to digital storage medium.
I just want to say one more thing that TiVos have done is change the way people are viewing commercials or not viewing commercials. So one of the things that it started to happen, you're going to see a lot more of, is product placement, which means they put the product actually, the commercial for a product and the product itself actually in the show you're watching.
But let's remember, Replay TV was slammed pretty hard.
Yeah, they had a 30-second button where you push the button and it automatically skips 30 seconds. They had to take that off.
TiVo did?
No, Replay TV did.
What about TiVo? TiVo has that same kind of feature.
No.
TiVo did have that feature long ago.
They had to remove it when Replay TV was forced to remove that feature. Okay. Now you can fast forward over.
Yeah. If you've recorded it.
And I hear you're going to see cable boxes come with TiVo-like features, except they're going to have slower fast forwards.
So you have to slow over the commercials.
Yeah. And people design the commercials to actually function differently when they're slow-mode quickly or gone over the fast.
Don't give them ideas.
Oh, geez. Thank you, John.
There's a new file system on the horizon. It's called Riser FS version 4.
Now, this is different than an operating system. It's a file system. Can you explain?
Right. File system, examples of existing file systems are DOS's file allocation table, or FAT, NT, you have NTFS. Folks who have been using Linux are probably familiar with the Riser FS. It's a journaling file system, meaning, for example, if you had a DOS machine or Windows machine and you didn't shut down properly, it would come back up and do a scan disk.
We're all familiar with that.
Right. That blue screen
takes a while,
that has a little progress bar.
You can skip this if you want, but if you do, you're going to go to hell kind of thing. And then it goes through the entire hard drive making sure that everything looks good.
Right. What Riser FS does is it journals information about what it's going to be doing and does in such a way that it writes to the journal, then does the write, then removes the entry from the journal. So the journal always has a record about what's going on, and you never have to worry about the file system being in an inconsistent state. If you come back up again, the journal isn't empty. It'll simply go back through and repair any damage or any writes that haven't been completed on the file system, which means that recovery time would be in sub-second as opposed to...
So at boot time... The file system looks at the journal and says, is there anything that didn't get closed? And then it erases that file and takes the journal entry out.
Now, that was the previous version.
Okay.
The version that's slated to be released on the 30th of this month has more database capabilities to it. In other words, it's adding a lot more querying functionality to the file system that was previously there. It also made it so that very small files could be saved efficiently. So what we're talking about is instead of having a program that does an index in its own database of MP3s, you could drop them into a directory and actually save attributes like what was normally the ID3 information, the song information, the artist, album, actually onto the file itself, and then make a file system query to search for things and order them.
So now the file system would know more information, therefore you won't have to open each file to determine the information.
Exactly.
Perfect in an MP3 situation where the files are actually quite large.
Yeah.
And but you already have an Edison.
They're talking about using it for email, where instead of having this one large mbox file, for example, a message box file is a common format for mail servers, or a dedicated database saving all of these files, you just save it on the file system. Each message is its own file, and you can save subject information, who it's from, who it's to, all that, as part of the file system attributes, and be able to query on that. It makes applications that much simpler to write.
Is this kind of like metadata that people might be used to from the Mac environment?
Except it's more tied to the file system itself.
Rather than the file.
It's more deeply embedded.
Of course, you're talking about the creator type and such that comes with Macs files, but that's actually in the top of the file itself. It's not actually part of the file operating system.
And it works on a plug-in-based system. So although you would have, on ResRFS 4, they're looking at, you have to do a recompile to be able to get any new plug-in in there. But being able to add functionality at will, just saying, I want my files to have a certain functionality, let me write a plug-in for it. There we go. Now I have all these file attributes available for it.
Great. Well, thank you, Miles. Before we get our discussion about 64-bit technology, I want to introduce the geeks and why they're all here. I talk with them every week. We have Dee Dee Hubbard. Dee Dee Hubbard is a recent dual graduate film and in computer engineering.
Computer science
from the University of California, Santa Cruz. She'll be moving relatively soon to New York, where she's going to her master's degree at NYU. Miles is also a student studying languages and soon to be a English teacher. He is experienced in programming on multiple fronts. His, I guess, forte at this point right now is probably filing systems, XML DOM and SACS DOM, XML, and yeah. XML experience with Java experience, and a web developer. He also does most of the primary development on geekspeak.org if you're interested in some of his design and that kind of thing. Sean Cleveland, formerly Boot Magazine, then Maximum PC. We had a site together, PC Extremist, years ago. He then worked for AMD and was wrote papers and such for AMD and Hypertransport Protocol. Pretty familiar with that. He is now currently at Transmeta, where again he is involved in PR
marketing of the
technology. Transmeta is a processor manufacturing company, a little different than AMD, Intel. They have a really different flow about how the process is designed, and maybe we'll do a show about that in the future. We then go to John Tracy. John Tracy, former employee of Apple, then most recently was working for San Lorenzo Valley Schools as a system administrator. He runs his own company, TraceComputing.com, where he can do home repair, office repair of computers and networks, specializing in Macs, but fluent in multiple operating systems, tracecomputing.com if you're interested in John's work. Currently, John is starting a new venture, Felton Games. A lot of us actually are geeks in the role-playing arena, and John will be selling lead figures online at feltongames.com. There's a little bit about the geeks. My name is Lyle Troxell, and I work for the University of California. Now, the reason why I went...
That's it? You just work for the University of California?
I do, in the arts division.
And he has a degree in electronics or something.
Oh, come on, Lyle.
Sure, we'll go on more about me. No. Okay, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that because Sean actually knows quite a bit about 64-bit technology by working from AMD, and we're going to be talking in a moment about Mac's new G5, which is a 64-bit machine. But first, let's talk a bit about what's going on with the Opteron and IBM, if you would, please.
Yeah, it was a big announcement this week. IBM is announced at Cluster World conference, which is in San Jose, a dual processor rack-mounted server that measures about 1.75 inches thick that will be shipping in the second half of this year. This is a big design win for AMD. Of course, any design win from a major OEM, especially of IBM, you know, their weight, especially in the server market, is huge, and basically it's a good win for AMD. It proves that their 64-bit technology has been tested to the point where IBM will spend a lot of money to actually make these available.
What operating system will these servers be running?
They'll be running Linux.
Okay.
So there's been a 64-bit version of Linux available for a year and a half now.
Oh, just for Opteron?
No, this is the final.
Okay, there's been a 64-bit Linux around for 10 years now.
Yeah.
Or not 10 years, what am I talking about? 6 years.
Oh, no, no, let me clarify that. There's been a 64-bit version of Linux that's compiled for AMD's 64-bit architecture for the past year and a half.
Okay.
So they've just been waiting for the processor to come out. And, of course, it's out now. And IBM, the difference is this is not a server. It's a server chip. But IBM's not making a server. They're making a cluster supercomputer.
Okay. Now, what is a cluster supercomputer?
Supercomputers, they only account for less than $1 billion a year in a market.
Oh, only $1 billion a year.
Whereas your typical desktop systems account for close to $6 billion. But basically what a cluster, Miles can probably explain this better than I can, but you know, one computer is powerful, but when you put a bunch of them together working on the same task, you know, they become much more powerful.
Okay.
And what these are made to work together in big environments on things such as modeling climate change, nuclear weapons physics, looking for oil in the Atlantic Ocean. I mean, all of those types of things require 64-bit address space and lots of processing power.
Because you're dealing with big numbers. And big.
Right.
You can think of your brain as a large cluster.
Okay, I'll do that every day. Thank you, Dee Dee. Sean, thank you very much. We're now going to move our discussion into the Apple arena. You're welcome to join our discussion. The phone numbers are 476-2800, toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. Apple, yesterday, Monday, announced its new machine, the G5, follow-up from its G4. But its underlying architecture, Apple is claiming, is very different. We might be a little abrasive today about what Apple's claims are, but bear with us. It should be interesting. Who wants to do the first rundown? Let's have Dee Dee, you want to do the first rundown on what Apple says they've got?
On Monday, Steve Jobs gave a keynote speech at the Worldwide Developers Conference, which is being held was being held in San Francisco, and he announced preview bits of the upcoming operating system Panther for 10.3, which will be running. It's 64-bit capable, so you're wondering, okay, what are you going to run it on? Do you have a 64-bit processor, which he did announce right afterwards? That's the G5, which IBM has been working on for like the past year now, at least.
I'm sure at least.
Now, IBM's actually making the processor?
Yeah. Right.
Now, is that traditional for Apple?
This is a little different. Oh, sorry.
Well,
this is a little different from Apple because Apple's typically gone with the Motorola. If you hear of the PowerPC chip, PowerPC is made by a coalition of Apple, IBM, and Motorola working together. Motorola has traditionally supplied the Apple chips. This is a departure from that because now they're getting their chips from IBM. One of the factors that's been cited for this is the lack of increase in speed in the current G4 chips. The G5, which is based on the 970 chip, goes faster.
Okay, currently the G4's max speed is what?
1.2
gigahertz, and the new G5 is touted at 2 gig.
1.4. Yeah, they come out at starting at 1.6, 1.8, and 2 gig.
Okay, so is it still the core of the chip? Is it still kind of is the instruction set very similar to the G4?
You still have AltaVec, and the key instructions needed to be binary compatible with the G4 and earlier programs. So you still have the compatibility of a G4, but you have the new raw power that IBM's Power 970 will give you.
Okay, so it's a switch over to AMD, possibly because
IBM.
IBM's
different three
processor,
letters.
Yeah. Away from Motorola, which I'm sure is going to sting Motorola a little bit, but I'm sure they've known about it for a while. Touting mostly because maybe Motorola hasn't been producing fast enough chips or haven't been growing as quickly.
Well, actually, on the Motorola front, they do have a new chip that will probably continue the G4 line because the G5 is probably not going to trickle down to portables or the more consumer line, the iMacs, until much, much, much later. So there still might be a speed bump for the G4. So the relationship with Motorola, it's just kind of more like the Motorola is happy with the G4, so they kind of went with IBM for the new
punch. Quote desktop. Now, one of the things that was said in this keynote, and then subsequently on an advertising that Apple's launched, is that this is the fastest desktop computer in existence. Why do they say that, Dee Dee?
They say that this is the fastest computer in
desktop
system. They're really pushing that it's the fastest personal computer.
Okay.
They believe that it can go up to 2 gigahertz. You have two processors running at two gigahertz with a dual gigahertz bus, front side bus.
Right.
It can go up to I forget all of the raw speed across the buses.
That's fine.
For which?
Across the CPU bus, you mean?
Yeah.
I think they were talking about 8 gigabits per second.
Yeah, that's it. And so it has all of this raw power plus the new 64-bit addressing, which allows a lot more memory to be accessed at any given point in time.
Okay, let's
break down that bus. 64-bit bus running at a gigahertz. 64 bits is 8 bytes, 8 times a gigahertz. 8 gigabytes a second.
Okay. Let's jump into the 64-bit technology, try to understand a little bit about that. Currently, most of the computers we're using, at least all the computers in the room, are running a 32-bit architecture. And prior to that, there was a 16-bit architecture, and probably the first 8080 chip, was an 8-bit. So every 5 years or so or more, machines move up to more addressing, a larger address bus. But let's talk about what that is. Miles, you want to try to tackle that real quick for us?
Well, one of the primary... there are two primary reasons I can think off the top of my head why you would want 64-bit over 32-bit or 32-bit over 16-bit for that matter, which is one being when you're doing a lot of mathematics with large numbers, if you have something that's over what 32 bits can handle, and this being either from 0 to 4 billion or negative 2 billion to positive 2 billion, a little bit of fuzzy.
Which is like the largest number you can deal with at one time?
Right.
Okay.
If you deal with numbers that are larger than that, if you deal with a 64-bit number, something that would be 7 billion, what you have to do is split that number into two instructions or into two values and then work on them independently to get out your final value when you're working with
them. So you'd have the speed in that case because then you'd have to deal with two numbers instead of one.
I would say less than half the speed because there's
a little bit of overhead.
Not just the mathematical operation, but splitting it off as well.
So dealing with extremely large numbers in that range, which I guess is kind of common for computers, 64-bit architecture allows you to deal with them cleaner.
For many scientific applications. For your general office applications, it won't make a difference.
It really helps in things like one of my professors is into computational medicine, and they deal with really large data sets that involve telling what certain features, a chemical or substrate that they're trying to make to study to see what its benefits are for medical applications.
Mm-hmm.
So they have little feature sets, so they could have a large string of these. And you wind up with these really large data sets, which you can't fit into memory, so you have to break it up all the time.
And that slows down
amounts of storage.
And that slows down your amount of processing power.
Right.
We're going to continue this discussion in just a moment. This program is supported by a grant from Santa Cruz Electronics, offering an extensive selection of computer and electronic parts, as well as support services. Santa Cruz Electronics is open daily at 2808 Soquel Avenue, online at santacruzelectronics.com. You're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air room with me are geeks John, Miles, Sean, and Dee Dee. The phone numbers to join our discussion are 476-2800 or toll-free at 1-800-655-5877. We can also get email geeks@geekspeak.org. This program is supported by a grant from Cruzio, providing internet services including DSL and spam filters for home and office throughout Santa Cruz County. Information about Cruzio membership is available online at cruzio.com or by calling 459-6301. We are discussing Macintosh computers and their new release. If you have an opinion or a thought about it, phone numbers are 476-2800. Toll free at 1-800-655-5877. Email address geeks@geekspeak.org. Okay, so Miles, you talked that 32 is faster than 64-bit
Well, 64 faster than 32 for very large numbers.
Okay, for very large numbers.
64 is larger than 32.
Thanks.
Not necessarily faster.
That's good. I was going to dive into what it means, 32 bits, but we won't. We've done that before. We're going to go on from there.
Yeah. Well, there's
what else can 64 do besides the
address more memory?
Okay. You mean RAM?
Yes, or even if you're talking about virtual memory, going just memory as a concept, doesn't have to be RAM. It could also be virtual memory running off the hard drive.
Now, why can a 32-bit instruction word not do as well as a 64-bit?
Okay, so a bit is either on or off. So that's two choice. There's two things that can happen right there. In the 32-bit register, you take that two and take it to the 32nd power. So 2 to 32nd power is about 4.3 billion possible, things that can happen within
numbers.
That bit range.
Sure.
So that's the limit of memory in the 32-bit architecture, is 4 gigabytes of memory.
Okay, so 4 gigs, meaning if you have more than that amount of RAM, that you don't have enough,
the operating
you don't
system
have enough pointers, if you will, to that RAM.
The operating system can't use
it. Is that a good way to describe it, Miles?
Well, one of the mainstays, for example, with C programming is you have a function called malloc, memory allocation. And the return value of that function is for 32-bit operating systems, is a 32-bit pointer, basically saying
a number, basically one of the numbers that can be arranged,
right,
in the
32-bit. Pointing to a point in memory,
which is a physical location of this array of memory that you have,
A translated
physical location.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And when you go to a 64-bit operating 64-bit platform, 64-bit operating system. Malloc would return back a 64-bit memory pointer.
Okay. So in Sean, when you were saying the 32-bit can address about 4 gigs, then if it's 64, you can double that?
Yeah. If you take 2 to the 64th power, you're talking about 18 billion bits.
So how much
amount of information?
How much
can
RAM
be
can be addressed then?
Over a terabyte. Yeah.
Yeah. So and 18 petabytes, something, or exabytes?
A lot of RAM.
Apple has a white paper out discussing G5 and the architecture, and they have a great example. Basically, they said if you took a 32-bit processor or processing and took all of the addressable bits in that 32 bits and mapped them over a two-dimensional area, you'd have the spot size of a postcard. Okay. In comparison, 64-bit addressing range would be about the size of Manhattan.
Island.
So the difference between 32 bits and 64 bits in addressable data is just
huge.
You know, the first thought is, okay, 4 gigs of RAM, that's a lot of RAM. And, you know, I could see someone maybe wanting, wow, you know, a terabyte. I mean, that's a lot of RAM. That's more than you could theoretically, you know, have. I mean, that's a lot of RAM. So there's no, you know, my first reaction is there's no way we're going to ever need a petabyte, right? But that's what happened when we went from 16 to 32. People were like, there's no way you're going to want 4 gigs of RAM. That's ridiculous.
Right.
But we're here.
There are scientists who will tell you that they need it.
Oh, there's a lot more than scientists. You're having a lot of people who are working with databases. The more you can have of a database in RAM, the better.
The faster.
And as you, and as you get to data sets that are easily larger than 4 gigabytes, you start running into performance issues, as it has to swap data back and forth to the hard drive, to a hard disk array, or something of that nature. And so being able to put in 16 gigabytes or 32 gigabytes or more or a terabyte of RAM ends up being huge performance gains for databases.
And that's going to be the reason why I think people upgrade to 64 bits. It's going to be because of memory.
Okay.
More so than the ability to address more bits.
Well, Apple's claim that it's the fastest desktop or fastest personal computer. The 64-bit technology really doesn't have anything to do with that, because what the things in the 64-bit technology that can actually increase speed really comes down to the large mathematical number situations, which people don't use in their personal computers.
Correct.
Well, actually, Apple...
No, that's correct.
Besides you, Didi. No, go on.
Apple is really out there for designers and even people who want to be designers. I'm not saying that in a negative sense.
Mm-hmm.
In any way. But they really push the digital lifestyle. So you have digital video, which...
Well, filters on digital video, sure, those are large numbers. No, ignore Sean, that's okay. Didi, you're talking about personal, video editing, yeah, you can use a lot of floating point stuff to do your transitions, a lot of video compositing.
Sound processing for people who are making music.
Sure.
We don't need 64 bits for any of that.
You don't
people
think
who
that?
Need like 64 bits are scientists who are doing exploration with large amounts of data, whether... anybody doing large encryption, I'm talking like hundreds and hundreds of
well,
bit-level
okay,
encryption.
I'd agree with you in general, Sean, but right now in the Wintel arena, the IBM, I'm sorry, the Intel and AMD chip arena, when people talk about video editing, you normally go, well, that's actually going to be addressed by the card, the video card. And that's actually true in the Mac arena as well. There's an independent processor that's specifically designed to process the video. So, but for video editing technology, that's not always capable to do that transition stuff using that processor.
I think it's a big question.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I agree with Sean with regards to the processing power when you're dealing with large numbers. That, I think, is more relegated to the scientific arena.
Yeah.
But memory addressing, I think, is...
Well, like I said, that's going to be the biggest reason why people who are doing the stuff that Didi was describing are going to want more memory.
Everybody wants
more
memory.
That's what's
going to
help them, more memory, not the 64-bit architecture.
And theoretically, even if you don't have as much memory and you have a lot of hard drive... if you don't have a lot of memory, then you're going to be going slower in general because you'll be caching more to the hard drive and stuff. So in that sense, it's going to speed the entire process up because your RAM can hold a lot more of your application.
Yeah, well, when you can take all the data that's in your in Photoshop in a huge picture and keep it in memory, yeah, of course you're going to work on that image much faster than you would if that data was being cached or swapped to the hard drive.
We're all high-end users, I would assume. Does anyone here max out their system with memory? Does anyone have 4 gigs of memory? No. But maybe the 64-byte technology will enable more machines to come out with more RAM.
Memory, if it stays at the price it's at, I mean, it's conceivable that people would go above a gig.
We should max our machines out. We should do that. It'd be fun.
I got a gig in one.
A gig in one? Yeah, yeah. I've got a gig in one.
I'd be more than willing to max out my name. Anyone want to buy the RAM for me?
It's not that expensive, actually. Okay, so Apple's claim that it's the fastest computer, fastest personal computer, doesn't really have to do about the 64-bit technology. So it has to be about something else. So let's talk about the other things that happen.
It's probably about skewed benchmarks.
Okay, well, I want to get into that. Let's touch on the stuff that it could be, assuming that there's no skewed benchmarks.
You know what, though? I applaud Apple for what they've done.
Okay, well, wait a second. I want to go into that.
There's a reason why they can say that they've done what they've done.
Okay. What are the other factors that make this this system faster than other systems out in the market? What's, like, you guys mentioned the...
Other Apple systems
the
or
front
other
side bus?
PC systems?
PC systems, any systems. They're saying it's
really
fast.
They've really paid attention to how data moves inside of a system. It's not about processor speed so much as system performance, because if there's any bottleneck inside your computer, it's going to slow down the performance of the whole system.
Okay, so what are some of the bottlenecks? We hear about front side bus. What is that?
The front side bus is the bus that transfers data from what's called the Northbridge chip. It's called a Northbridge because it's a chip that's above PCI, and a Southbridge is the chip that's below it. That's in class, that's basic terminology.
The PCI is the place where you put
your cards. Northbridge, what it controls is information flow of information to memory, to your video card, to the processor, and then all your I/O below it. And your I/O is your hard drives, your USB, FireWire, anything else connected to the processor. So the front side bus is that bus between the Northbridge and the processor.
Okay, so and that's where the memory allocation is. And
memory is actually connected to the Northbridge.
Okay, so
this is in Apple's architecture.
Okay, so the front side bus really connects this like hub system to the processor.
Exactly.
So what flows in that hub system? What is actually flowing between the processor and that hub? What information?
Whenever you launch an application, the application needs to be copied into memory. So what's going to happen is going to be copied down from your I/O up to the Northbridge into memory.
Okay,
and then from memory, you start executing the application, and it needs the processor to do the execution.
But the front side bus only happens during the execution of the thing.
Well, once you've actually launched an application into memory, everything that happens after that happens between the front side bus, between memory and the processor.
So it's really the processor being able to do all the things that it does. It uses the front side bus.
Right.
So let's say you've got a really fast processor and a really slow front side bus. You've got a situation where the processor is going to be waiting a lot
for
data.
It's like sucking a shake through a straw.
Okay.
Now, what Apple has done, Intel has dual Xeon architecture that competes in this space with a single front-side bus. Apple has put in two dual independent front-side buses so that each processor can access data through the full bandwidth of the front-side bus because they each have their own, whereas Intel's sharing their front-side bus.
But Apple, you're saying that Apple's new, because the G5 is a dual processor, it's got two front-side buses. They don't interfere with each other.
Right.
Okay, that's a good thing.
But that's not revolutionary because AMD has been doing that for the last year and a half.
Well, and in fact, it's pretty common in high-end servers and high-end mainframe. I think Apple has learned a lot. They have a server called the XServe, and I think they've learned a lot in doing the XServe because they seem to be bringing a lot of server architecture into their desktop machines.
That's been kind of the paradigm for a long time. You get this, you get your personal computers are kind of low end, like what you can afford kind of thing, and then you get the supercomputer kind of systems that are going to be in labs and going to be on servers, and then you slowly kind of migrate the personal computer towards that server, and the server keeps going.
Right.
The question I have then, we'll jump into this now, with Apple's price on this current G5, is that where? What arena is that in? Is that a personal computer, a workstation, or a server? on the price range.
I see it more as a workstation.
Okay, now workstation...
Maybe low-end server, small office.
Workstation means probably not personal machine, probably more of like something you'd use if you were a professional in an arena where you need a lot of processing power. Is that a workstation?
Yeah, design houses, corporations.
But Apple's always had their machines around that price range, between the two... Between the $1,500 and $3,000 range.
It's a lot of money, though, compared to what you can build on the PC.
How much is this G5? $2,000?
No, it's between $2,000
and $3,000. Okay. And we're really not supposed to be talking about prices and such, but this is news information. So the other machines, a personal computer that could do a lot of what Didi was talking about, video editing, all that, what kind of price range are we talking there?
You could buy a PC for less than $1,000 that's cutting edge.
In fact, you have a great article on geekspeak.org that talks about a machine that's relatively inexpensive.
Can that one do video stuff?
Yeah. You can do video editing.
Yeah, sure.
It's got the software and everything.
Oh, no, you'd have to buy the software.
The processor is powerful enough to do most of the video editing.
You would have to buy the software. That's a good point. Mac is giving a lot of the video editing for iLife stuff part of the operating system.
Yeah, you actually should talk about what comes with that $2,000 to $3,000 because it's true. You don't even get an operating system with those sub $1,000 PCs.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk a little bit more about the architecture. That's the front side bus. What's the speed that they're running at?
Well,
the G5.
It depends on which model you're getting. They go anywhere from 800 up to gigahertz. If you get the 1.6, it's got an 800 megahertz bus. If you get the 1.8 gigahertz, it's got a 900 megahertz bus. If you get
It's kind of dependent on the processor itself.
Right.
Sean, what is the arena in the Intel where their duals, they're sharing one front side bus? What is the speed of that bus?
That bus is, I believe, at 800 megahertz right now.
Okay. And what about AMD's front side bus? Like the Opteron, which IBM's now using.
Okay. Well, no, the Athlon XP or the Athlon MP is the dual, is only at 400 megahertz right now.
AMD's got dual 400 megahertz. And that's not 64-bit.
But you got to understand AMD's Opteron and the forthcoming Athlon 64 has the memory controller built into the processor. So there is no front side bus.
So you remove the front side bus.
So their front side bus is at the full speed of the processor. So every time you get a faster Opteron or Athlon 64 processor, your memory bandwidth is increased.
Which is interesting because Apple is definitely ahead of the times from the Opteron situation because AMD's Opteron's not really out for the mass market. And, well, Apple says it's going to be out in August.
Well, Athlon 64 should be out in August, September timeframe.
Okay, so maybe they're around the same time.
And that's a 64-bit chip as well.
All right. What other issues are controlling speed of this machine from a technology perspective?
Well, one of the biggest bottlenecks is the bus between the North Bridge and the South Bridge. So that's between the processor, memory, and your video, and everything else that it's actually all your I.O.
Your hard drives.
Your hard drive, your USB, your FireWire, how you get all your data into your computer. Is located in a chip in the South Bridge, and that bus is just been a dog.
Okay, what's
so recently? So, in the past they used PCI, which is only 133 megahertz, 32 bit, can only move one direction at a time. There's been proprietary buses. Intel's Hublink architecture is 66 megahertz. I think they can go up to 33 or 100 megahertz as well. 32 bit, still rather slow.
Mm-hmm. What's this G5 doing?
Everyone's believes they're using hypertransport. Now, I say that, and they say they're using hypertransport. But hypertransport right now, the specification only says that it can go up to 800 megahertz, up to 32-bit, which is about 12.8 gigabytes per second of aggregate throughput. That's total throughput both ways.
Which is a lot faster.
Very fast, low pin count, low power bus. It's great for chip-to-chip communication. But somehow they're doing it at a gigahertz. Which
so
has got a lot of people.
New in hypertransport coming out then?
No one's net that I've heard of. So a lot of people are scratching their heads as to how they're doing that.
Interesting. So there could be something, some magic going on there, or it could be something.
Inside the consortium, and I only know this because I worked in it.
The hypertransport
consortium. There has always been talk between engineers that they could conceivably push the speed of the bus up to a gigahertz, and I'm wondering if maybe Apple has just done that.
Just decided what the heck, let's do it. Okay. So that's kind of the underlying of what the specs say this machine is. And, yeah, the specs are kind of in there it can be definitely a very fast machine from a lot of perspective, especially since they're switching over from Apple's 1.2 gigahertz to a 2 gigahertz processor, and they're selling this as a dual. Are they only selling this as a dual?
No.
No. Okay. So they have a single.
IBM has said that this chip has the ability to go up to 4 gigahertz, and in fact, before 2005, they hope to have it there. So look for 4 gigahertz Apples by 2005, which should be more in keeping with what Intel and AMD are offering.
Well, except for there'll be AMD and Intel will be doubling probably. Well,
they're at 3.2 right now?
Something like that.
Yeah. Just an important note for folks out there. While the clock speed matters to some extent, the clock speed only really matters relative to another chip of the same type. In other words, a PowerPC chip that's 1 gigahertz versus one that's 1.2.
Right.
You could see the speed difference there. But saying a 2 gigahertz G5 is not the same as a 2 gigahertz Pentium 4.
Okay. That's really a big issue, is that you don't really know how to measure those. So let's talk about a bit about the measurements do that.
If this is a PowerPC-based chip, computer, Microsoft made a PowerPC version of Windows NT at one point. Does that mean these could run Windows NT conceivably?
Except they dropped it. So
why would you ever want to spend money on Mac hardware than run XP?
I'm just curious.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah, I'm curious too.
They dropped development on it a while ago, so I don't know if it would support the newer generation of chips or maybe some incompatibility.
You should be able, though, to install Linux on it because Linux does have a PowerPC version, or you can file to it for PowerPC. Okay, let's talk about... So that's kind of the architecture of the system. It's really kind of complex. Apple's saying, in a marketing perspective, this is the fastest desktop ever. They're backing that up by showing this, quote, independent company doing benchmarks. Can we address that a little bit? John, are these benchmarks realistic? Are they true? Or are they being honest?
Oh, Apple would never lie. No, I think most benchmarks you get are going to be slewed. And these in particular, they had multi-threading turned off. They had Sean, you know a little bit more about what Apple actually runs.
There's no accounting. If you go to Apple's website and you try to see what are the specifications of the systems they tested and how are they set... There's not a lot of information in that, though.
DD, you did some
aside from hardware.
Did you go ahead? You did some research on that?
No, it's just that there's a PDF that states all the benchmarking schemes, what they did, and specifies what tests they conducted.
So you feel they're being forthcoming on how the tests were performed?
Anybody can go and look at and read the PDF.
Now, see, the PDF isn't talking about how BIOS settings are set on the Intel system.
Now, Sean, is it your thought that the people that tested the machines, basically what happened was a company did tests for the new G5 for an AMD and an Intel box. Is that correct?
Right.
Or is it just, okay. No. And did the same kind of things on all those machines and saw how they performed.
The difference is, like AMD, when they do benchmarks, they post all the information, and then they go to Arthur Anderson and say, would you please look at our benchmarks and make sure that they're correct? And they go off and they do that. And then basically it tells the community, especially the investing community, that they have a third party who's actually looking at this stuff, whereas Apple didn't do any of that.
I'm sorry, Arthur Anderson as in Anderson Consulting?
Yes.
Yeah,
you could speculate all you want, but I think they're still workers. They're still moving. I mean, if you go up and look at the PDF, there's no information in it. I'm looking at it now.
Okay, we've been geeking out for a good 50 minutes. Let's go ahead and let Ted from Santa Cruz ask a question. Ted, welcome to Geek Speak. I'm sorry, Ted, can you start that over? Welcome to Geek Speak.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks.
Good to finally catch you. I don't catch this hour usually. I'm working, but today I get to listen. My question, I'm not sure if I'm asking the right people, but I work at a school. I'm a technology coordinator down in Salinas. And we are Windows 2000 environment, Windows 2000 servers, Windows 2000 workstations. I need a laptop, and I'm trying to decide between a Windows laptop and a Mac. And one of our techs is a Mac lover. He's got his G4 PowerBook running OS 10, and he loves that it's Unix-based and has a command line. He says it's pretty seamless dealing with a Windows 2000 environment. He can access any part of the network he needs to. So I don't quite understand all that. I'd love to get a OS 10 Mac if I could. I'm wondering what you guys think.
Okay, so your basic question is Mac or PC?
Exactly.
Oh, that'll be really easy for us to answer. No. let's answer it first by saying there are five geeks in the room, myself included. Three of them have G4 PowerBooks. And two of them have Windows machines.
Okay.
That doesn't necessarily mean that we're all net guys. Also, all of us have Windows machines, personally. I probably wouldn't have a Mac if I didn't have one for work. the Macintosh, let's talk real quick about the G4 PowerBook, or the titanium, as it's called, and then the new aluminum?
Yeah. Aluminum.
They're great machines. OS X is a really wonderful operating system, very easy. If you're used to a Windows environment, a lot of the wonderfulness of it is not necessarily great for you personally, because in a Windows environment, you'd probably be very comfortable. I would say if you're coming from a Macintosh environment and you're wondering what type to buy, I would probably stick with Mac, because the learning curve is going to be less. That said, can somebody else give their opinion?
If you're really price sensitive, you go for a Windows-based laptop. And I'm one of those folks that has the Windows-based laptop, but at the same time, it depends. The processor is a little bit slower in the Mac laptops, but the laptops, I think, as hardware overall, are designed better.
You know, I'd say I haven't seen a laptop that, from a hardware perspective, is as nice as a titanium or an AI.
But you'll have to pay for it.
Now, they also have iBooks, and the iBooks are much less expensive. They have a plastic casing. They're smaller screened. And they run OS X. You're going to find all the features and such that you know, quote, need in the iBook, and it's going to be a lot cheaper.
Are G3s, right?
Right.
Are there G4 iBooks?
No, they're not.
So it's just G3.
That's right.
So, well, my purchasing needs are price sensitive, but at the same time, if spending a little more and getting a much better machine up front, especially in terms of long range durability and lifespan. In terms of operating system, I'm used to both, although I have, for the last few years, been working almost entirely in Windows.
Macs tend to age better.
Yeah,
that is true.
Yeah, and look at the apps that you're going to be running. Make sure they're available for the Mac as well.
Uh-huh.
Sean, what's your feeling? You're definitely a PC guy. Laptop buying, PC, Mac?
Well, I don't know Mac very well.
Well,
PC.
Go ahead and tell PC laptops.
PC laptop, you could go to Dell, but I think you're going to find better deal elsewhere.
Okay.
From people I know who purchased Dell, they've had
problems.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to buy a Windows laptop right now, where would you go?
I'd look at IBM. I'd look at Sony.
Okay.
HP notebooks aren't that bad either.
So you can do some research by going to IBM, going to Sony, take a look at what the features are, what the prices are, then look at like a G4 titanium.
Yeah.
And see the prices and stuff.
I guess the best advice I can give you is do not buy a personal
Windows XP personal.
A consumer-based notebook.
Uh-huh. Buy something for the professional.
Yes,
market.
Professional business, because you're going to find that they're made better.
Mm-hmm.
The cases are stronger. They'll probably have more of the features that you're looking for, and possibly some of the applications as well.
And in the Mac arena, and actually any laptop, you purchase a laptop, especially the titanium, the screen is extremely thin. You're also going to find this in Sony's. It looks real nice and elegant. The only issue is that if you put that in a backpack and you have a book next to it that's, you know, the corners going into it, you'll crack the screen pretty easily when it's closed even. So what you want to do on any laptop you get, you want to get a carrying case that is strong and durable. Very important on really thin laptops. And one of the most important is the side that the screen is on. Get some kind of board or a large book that covers the entire area that's very strong. So it's flat and always flat and doesn't have, you know, a pencil laying against it.
Right.
I want to address your concerns about a Mac in a Windows environment.
Yeah.
I'm mostly a Mac person, and I've had to function always in a Windows environment. And with OS X, I found it's a much, much easier than it's ever been to connect to a Windows network or to share your files or to get files or to find printers. It's becoming much easier. In fact, I went to a conference where they had a printer, and you could only use the computers that were right next to the printers. But they had a wireless point also, and I was able, because I had a Mac, I was able to go and print to that printer where the Windows machines couldn't. So the OS X operating system is much better at integrating itself into networks. And now there's a new operating system, 10.3 coming out, which is called Panther, that's supposed to be addressing Windows network ability even better.
Yeah, wireless is good, especially if you want to access other places. Other things you want to look at are high-speed connectivity like USB 2.0 or FireWire, because you will use it.
Right.
You also want to look at just as far as the box goes, the notebook goes, you kind of just look at the feature set. Look at what it has on it. Think about how you'll be using it. If this is your desktop system and this is going to be your only system, when you're looking at video and you're going to hook a monitor up to it, make sure it's at a resolution that you want, because a lot of notebooks have, you know, crappy resolutions. They look good on the notebook that they're on because the screen's so small.
Ted, thank you. Things to think about. Thank you very much for the call. Good luck on your purchase.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. We are not going to get into Panther today because we are almost out of time. Any wrap-ups on Mac G5?
Actually, I wanted to say AMD doesn't use Arthur Andersen anymore. They use PricewaterhouseCooper.
Okay, that's a good point.
But the point is maybe Apple should consider using somebody
independent
for their auditing. Firm. Yeah,
okay.
They wouldn't have this problem.
Okay. Didi, do you have any other closing issues about the G5?
No.
Okay. I'm interested personally in looking at one and seeing one when they come out. Don't believe everything you read. And if you are about to purchase something on a Mac and Arena and you're thinking, well, should I wait or not, they're going to be expensive. The only other thing is the new operating system, the Panther operating system, is an upgrade. It costs money, and you might want to get a computer when that's released as an operating system. You might want to wait till the Mac's released at that point so that you can get that new operating system. Closing thoughts from any of you? Geeks, thank you very much. The Geeks this morning were John Tracy, Sean Cleveland, Dee Dee Hubbard, Miles Elam. This program is supported by a grant from Seagate Technology. Seagate is a worldwide supplier of disk drives for PCs and servers and innovations for products like the Microsoft Xbox, digital video recorders, and digital jukeboxes. Information is at Seagate.com. Geeks, thanks. Thanks, Ted, for calling in. Our producer is Maggie Cleveland. She also answers the phone when you call in for Geek Speak. We'll be back next week, as we are every week, Fridays at 10 a.m. You can find out more about the show at geekspeak.org. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP Santa Cruz, KBH San Ardo, or on the web at kusp.org. I'm Lyle Troxell, and this was Geek Speak. Stay tuned now for Fine Print.